And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, it's June 27th, 2022, 178th day of the year. 187 days remain till the year's over with. With all the decisions by the Supreme Court the left doesn't like, they're losing their tiny little minds. They're threatening this and that and the other if they don't get their way. Even though I've been a Democrat all my life, I am ashamed of the Democratic Party and the way they're acting. They're not children, they're adults. If the court goes against them, find a reason to reopen the case. Doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure that out. Well, as I said, this is June 27th. On this day in 1358, the Republic of Lagusa is founded. 1497, Cornish rebels Michael Angoff and Thomas Flammoc executed at Tyburn in London, England. That's the famous Tyburn Gallows. 1499, Amerigo Vespucci on Spanish finance trips sighted the coast south of Cape Cassipore. 1556, the 13 Stratford martyrs are burned at the stake near London for their Protestant beliefs. Believe the way we tell you to or die. That's what folks love to say. We got a lot of those here. 1743, in the Battle of Dettingen, George II becomes the last reigning monarch to participate in a battle. Other than the fights with Parliament. 1760, Anglo-Cherokee War. Cherokee warriors defeat British forces at the Battle of Ekui near present-day Ottawa, North Carolina. 1806, British forces take Buenos Aires during the first of the British invasions of the River Plate. 1844, Joseph Smith founded the Latter-day Saint movement, and his brother Hiram Smith are killed by a mob at the Carthage, Illinois jail. If you don't believe as we tell you to, you're gonna die. 1864, American Civil War. Confederate forces defeat Union forces in the Battle of Kennesaw Mountain during the Atlanta campaign. Say what you will, the Confederates had some brilliant field commanders. 1895, the inaugural run of the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad Royal Blue from Washington, D.C. to New York City. This was the first U.S. passenger train to use electric locomotives. I'd like to have seen that extension cord. 1898, the first solo circumnavigation of the globe is completed by Joshua Slocum from Briar Island in Nova Scotia. 1905, during the Russo-Japanese War, sailors start a mutiny aboard the Russian battleship Potemkin. 1914, the Illinois Monument is dedicated at Cheatham Hill and what's now the Kennesaw Mountain National Battlefield Park. 1927, Prime Minister of Japan, Tanaka Gichi, convenes an 11-day conference to discuss Japan's strategy in China. The Tanaka Memorial, a forged plan for world domination, is later claimed to be a secret report leaked from this conference. 1928, the Rovaniemi Township decrees promulgated, as a result of which, Rovaniemi succeeded from the old rural municipality as its own market town, January 1, 1929. Now, for those who are not familiar with this, it's a city, municipality in Finland, the administrative capital and commercial center of Finland's northernmost province, Lapland, and its southern part, Pohjola. The city center is situated about 4 miles south of the Arctic Circle. And I'd say it was probably a little cold there. 1941, Romanian authorities launched one of the most violent pogroms in Jewish history in the city of Lasi, resulting in the murder of at least 13,266 Jews. I don't understand. 1941, World War II, German troops captured the city of Bialystok during the Operation Barbarossa. Also in 44, World War II, Bogong is the first place in Burma to be liberated from the Japanese by British Chindits, supported by the Chinese. 1946, in the Canadian Citizenship Act, the Parliament of Canada establishes the definition of Canadian citizenship. 1950, U.S. decides to send troops to fight the Korean War. 1954, the Omnitsk nuclear power plant, the Soviet Union's first nuclear power station, opens in Omnitsk near Moscow. 1954, the FIFA World Cup quarterfinal match between Hungary and Brazil, highly anticipated to be exciting, turned violent. Three players ejected and further fighting continued even after the game. I have to wonder about people who are that into a game that they'll fight about it. 1957, Hurricane Audrey makes landfall near the Texas-Louisiana border. Kills over 400, mainly in and around Cameron, Louisiana. 1973, the president of Uruguay, Juan Maria Bordaberry, dissolves parliament and establishes a dictatorship. 1974, U.S. President Richard Nixon visits the Soviet Union. 1976, Air France Flight 139, Tel Aviv to Athens to Paris, is hijacked en route to Paris by the PFLP and redirected to Entebbe, Uganda, where Dr. Idi Amin Dada got involved. 1977, France grants independence to Djibouti. 1980, the Ustica Massacre. Atavia Flight 870 crashes in the sea while en route from Bologna to Palermo, Italy, killing all 81 people on board. 1981, a Central Committee of the Chinese Communist Party issues its resolution on certain questions in the history of our party since the founding of the People's Republic of China. Lays the blame for all the problems caused by the Cultural Revolution on Mao Zedong and the way that folks are carrying on today. I'm surprised they didn't add Trump's name. 1982, Space Shuttle Columbia launched from the Kennedy Space Center on the final research and development flight mission, STS-4. 1988, the Gare de Lyon rail accident in Paris, France, kills 56. 1988, Villa Tunari massacre. Bolivian anti-narcotics police kill 9 to 12 and injure over 100 protesting coca-growing peasants. 1991, 2 days after it declared independence, Slovenia is invaded by Yugoslav troops, tanks, and aircraft. Started the 10 days war, don't you know? 1994, members of the Shinriko cult released sarin gas in Matsumoto, Japan. 7 people are killed, 660 are injured. 2007. Tony Blair resigned as British Prime Minister, a position he had held since 1997. His Chancellor, Gordon Brown, succeeds him. Also in 2007, Brazilian military police invades the favelas of Complexo de Alameo in an episode that is remembered as the Complexo de Alameo Massacre. 2008, in a highly scrutinized election, President of Zimbabwe, Robert Mugabe, is reelected in a landslide after his opponent, Morgan Tsvangirai, had withdrawn a week earlier, citing violence against his party supporters. 2013, NASA launches the Interface Region Imaging Spectrograph, a space probe to observe the sun. 2014, at least 14 people are killed when a Gas Authority of India limited pipeline explodes in the East Godavari district of Andhra Pradesh, India. 2015, Formosa Funcoast Fire. A dust fire occurs at a recreational water park in Taiwan, kills 15 and injures 497 others, 199 of those critically. And in 2017, a series of powerful counterattacks during the Petya malware target website of Ukrainian organizations and counterparts with Ukrainian connections around the world. Although not counterattacks, cyberattacks. Duh, I can't read. Just had my contact lenses replaced. They must have put them in backward, and I'm seeing things behind me. All right. A lot of births and deaths on this date in history. Holidays observances. Christian Feast Day. Arialdo christens one of the 70 disciples. Cyril of Alexandria in the Coptic Church, Roman Catholic Church, Anglican Communion, and Lutheran Church. Ladislaus I of Hungary, Our Lady Perpetual Help. Samson the Hospitable. Zoilus, Canadian Multiculturalism Day in Canada, Commemoration Day for the Victims of the Communist Regime in Czech Republic, Day of Turkmen Workers of Culture and Art and Poetry of Mektemgudi in Turkmenistan, Helen Keller Day in the U.S., Independence Day in Djibouti, which celebrates independence of Djibouti from France in 1977, Mixed Race Day in Brazil, National HIV Testing Day in the U.S., National PTSD Awareness Day in the U.S., and Seven Sleepers Day in Germany, Unity Day in Tajikistan. Well, let's see what else we got. There's a lot going on today. Okay. Okay. In 678, Saint Agatho begins his reign as Catholic Pope. 992, the Battle of Conquerieu, won by the Count of Anjou, Fulk the Black, defeating Conan I, Count of Brittany in western France. 1358, the Republic of Dubrovnik is founded. 1542, Juan Rodriguez Cabrillo sets sail from the Mexican port of Navidad to explore the west coast of North America on behalf of the Spanish Empire. He was both a conquistador and an explorer, looking for the gold. 1552, Cathedral Church of Caracas, established in Caracas, Spanish Empire. Later, La Plata, now Sucre in Bolivia. 1580, the Duke of Alva's army occupies Portugal. 1652, New Amsterdam, now New York City, enacts the first speed limit law in North America. 1693, the first sea battle of Lagos. A French fleet under Anne-Hilarion de Tourville defeated an Anglo-Dutch fleet under George Rooke. 1697, Polish Parliament selects the monarch August of Saxony as king. 1709, Peter the Great of Russia defeats Charles XII of Sweden at the Battle of Poltava. Charles goes into exile. 1743, War of Austrian Succession, Battle of Dettingen in Bavaria. King George II of Britain personally leads troops into battle. 1746, Flora MacDonald helps Bonnie Prince Charlie, disguised as Betty Burke, an Irish maid, evade capture by landing him on the Isle of Skye. Bonnie Prince Charlie was the pretender to the British throne. 1756, the French fleet occupies St. Philip's Castle of Menorca. 1759, British General John Wolfe begins the siege of Quebec. 1778, the Liberty Bell returns home to Philadelphia after the British leave. 1789, French Revolution. Louis XVI orders the nobility and the clergy of the Estates General to meet with the Third Estate, by then called the National Assembly. 1806, Buenos Aires captured by the British. 1833, Prudence Crandall, a white woman, arrested for conducting an academy for black females at Canterbury in Connecticut. Who cares? 1847, New York and Boston linked by telegraph wires. 1857, Bibihar massacre 120 British women and children following the siege of Cawnpore. 1857, James Donnelly becomes engaged in a drunken brawl with Patrick Farrell, who suffers a fatal blow to the head. Farrell dies 2 days later, which makes Donnelly a wanted man and draws the Donnelly family into the notorious feud. Donnelly was basically he was the patriarch of the Donnelly family, also known as the Black Donnellys. Family participated in a notorious feud in Biddulph Township in Middlesex County, Ontario, which culminated in a massacre in which five family members were killed. He was born in Ireland and was murdered in 1880 at the age of 63. Okay, 1862, Battle of Garnett's Golding's Farm in Virginia. 1862 also saw the Battle of Gaines' Mill in Virginia. Today was day three of that battle. 1863, skirmish at Fairfax Courthouse of Virginia. 1864, Atlanta Campaign, Battle of Kennesaw Mountain. Sherman makes an unsuccessful frontal attack on Confederate defensive positions. 1867, the Bank of California opened its doors on this date. 1876, Democratic Party elects Samuel Tilden as U.S. presidential candidate. I think he was a collateral relative. 1890, Cecil Rhodes colonists attack Mount Lucy in Matabeleland. He was an imperialist politician. 1890, Canadian boxer George Dixon becomes the first black world champion when he stops English bantamweight champion Edwin Nunk Wallace in 18 rounds in London. 1893 saw the great stock crash on New York Stock Exchange. 1894, American Annie Londonderry, also known as Annie Kopchowski, sets out from Boston to become the first woman to bicycle around the world. She completed the journey September 1895. 1896, a review of Paul Laurence Dunbar, second book, Majors and Minors by William Dean Howells in Harper's Weekly, brought the poet to national attention, in spite of the fact he was black. Which shows me that intelligence doesn't respect color. You can be just as dumb as a brick if you're white as if you're black. 1898, Canadian-American adventurer Joshua Slocum arrives in Newport, Rhode Island, completed the first solo circumnavigation of the globe. His boat was the Spray. He sailed 46,000 miles around the world. 1914, on this date, defending champion Jack Johnson beats fellow American Frank Moran on points in 20 rounds in Paris, France, to retain his lineal heavyweight boxing championship. 1914, U.S. signed a treaty of commerce with Ethiopia. 1915, the Dutch SDAP demonstrated against conscription. 1917, Venizelos takes over as Prime Minister of Greece and severs relations with the Central Powers, which brought Greece onto the side of the Allies in World War I. 1922, the Newbery Medal was first presented for kids' literature to Hendrik van Loon. 1923, Captain Lowell Smith and Lieutenant John Richter performed the first ever aerial refueling in a DH-4B biplane. I bet they didn't clean the windshields. 1929 saw the first color TV demonstration performed by Bell Labs in New York City. 1929, President Paul von Hindenburg, former German general, refused to pay German debts from World War I. 1934, the Federal Savings and Loan Association is created. 1939 saw the first night game at Cleveland Municipal Stadium. The Indians beat the Tigers 5-0. 1940, on this date, the Soviet Army attacked Romania. In 1942, the FBI captured 8 Nazi saboteurs from a sub off New York's Long Island. In 1942, the PQ-17 convoy leaves Iceland for Arkhangelsk. In 1944, on this date, Cherbourg, France, revelated by the Allies. 1950, the U.S. sent 35 military advisors to South Vietnam. 1950, North Korean troops elite Seoul. The U.N. asked members to aid South Korea. Harry Truman ordered the U.S. Air Force and Navy into the Korean conflict. 1950, South Africa heeded the U.N. call to assist Korea. 1954, CIA-sponsored rebels overthrow the elected government of Guatemala. 1955, the first automobile seatbelt legislation is enacted in Illinois. 1958, Harry Burrell flies KC-135 in record time, 5 hours, 27 minutes, 42.8 seconds from New York to London. 1960, British Somaliland becomes part of Somalia. 1962, Ross Perot begins electronic data systems. He is also a presidential candidate. 1962, in South Africa, the General Law Amendment Act, also called the Sabotage Act, number 76, starts, increasing the state president's power to declare organizations unlawful, to add further restrictions to banning orders. 1963, U.S. Air Force Major Robert Rushworth in the X-15 reaches 86,900 miles. 1966, in a day I still remember, Dark Shadows, the American Gothic soap opera, premieres on ABC TV. Barnabas Collins. 1970, following the arrest of Bernadette Devlin, there were intense riots in Derry and Belfast, leading to a prolonged gun battle between Irish Republicans and Loyalists. 1972, legendary video game and home computer Atari was founded on this date by Nolan Bushnell and Ted Dabney in Sunnyvale, California. I had one of the originals. I gave it to the son of a friend. Let's see if there's anything else of interest. In 1979, heavyweight champion Muhammad Ali confirms his third retirement is final. It wasn't, but he said it was. 1979, Supreme Court ruled employers may use quotas to help minorities, and nobody protested about that, but on abortion, they're bouncing off walls still. Alrighty. Well, we come to the end of that particular segment. And now we're going to talk about We've been talking about strange, unexplained murders and disappearances. We've got a story we were talking about a strange creature attacking a young lady. Her name was Camilla. And her back was torn open by a creature just dropped out of the sky. Well, about 15 minutes after the police arrived, a large black SUV showed up. A couple of casually dressed men got out of the vehicle and flashed their badges to the already present police officers. And they insisted on seeing the smartphone footage of the attack. They turned the volume all the way up, and they continually reviewed the part where the creature attacked the girl while she was on top of her boyfriend. Well, after they reviewed the footage, they insisted everybody hand over their cell phones. Now, they said if they didn't, they could face significant hurdles with government agencies such as the IRS. Now, I've never seen a non-IRS agent threaten somebody with bringing in the IRS. I've seen a number of federal agencies just ignore their duties and responsibilities. Well, they handed over their phones. And these casually dressed men went to the photo and video gallery and airdropped that footage from the people's phones onto their own. Turns out that only one of the young ladies had captured the creature on the iPhone. After all was done, they reviewed the driver's license, informing us that the young lady be taken to a special facility and get transferred to the nearest hospital. They were given a number to the hospital and told to call the next few hours to find out whether she'd been admitted or not. Well, they spent the next few hours calling at the hospital every 20 minutes. And then one of them got a call from the girl's father, wanting to know what happened to the daughter. He said they just got off the phone and found out their daughter died from loss of blood. Now, the hardest thing she said she ever had to do was tell them what had happened. It was a birthday out of hell, she said. She explained they were having a good time at the swimming pool when a giant bird attacked out of nowhere. And if one of the young men hadn't interceded, it would have actually taken the daughter away. Now, it was unthinkable she died, but the idea of her having ended up in some nest and being eaten alive was definitely disturbing. As far as they could figure out, what they encountered was what people referred to as a Thunderbird. Of course, everything happened so fast that they didn't get a lot of detailed observations, such as they didn't know if the creature had feathers or what. One of them made the comment, whatever it was, the body reminded her of a dinosaur, but his head was more bird-like. But everybody who was present described it the same way. And one of them said they'd always wonder about the details of those strange men who arrived after the first responders and asked for the cell phones. They never said what branch of government they worked for, and if they're going to show up and flash their badges, they're required to tell you where they're from. And they also wanted to know the specifics of that special facility the girl was taken to. The suspicion was. They wanted to document the wounds and maybe acquire DNA samples that the creature left behind. For quite some time, one of the participants thought about a strategy. If should be visited by officials looking to learn more about what they saw. As far as she knew, the authorities never again contacted any of them. And enough time has passed that it's clear that's not going to happen. But what rubbed her the wrong way was how the obituary implied that she died unexpectedly while at a party. It made it sound like she either died from a drug overdose or maybe too much alcohol. Even her family seemed to disregard the idea of a wild animal killing her. The implication that, the implication everybody got was even the family assumed her injuries might have been falling out of the above ground pool, landing on a jagged rock. And everybody who was there was a bit offended by the apparent dismissal of what they said. But they decided to respect the family, and it does make you wonder how many people fall victim to these kinds of attacks and end up getting silenced by the government. And, you know, it makes me wonder some of the stories about there being a secret government agency designed to investigate these type of attacks might not be true. Well, we've got another story. Name is Michael. Back in the 70s, he was determined to be a Broadway actor. Wasn't, you know, pining to be a star or anything. Just wanted to work consistently and earn enough to afford a modest living. But when the first 6 months of living in Hoboken, New Jersey, saw something never forget. As I say, his name was Michael, and he grew up in Long Island, New York. Typical theater geek who often got picked on by the jocks. And it was hard to feel like he had any escape from the torment because he had to come home to a household full of sporty individuals every day. His father had been all-conference quarterback in college, and both of his older brothers were all-star baseball players. And even the mother ran track at the same college that the father played at. So it was easy for him to feel like the odd one out. And there are many occasions where his father and his brothers would be in the living room watching some big game, while he was in his room rehearsing a scene from Hamlet. It wasn't that his family was disrespectful. It's just that it seemed to be very little they could relate over. And because of that, Michael couldn't wait to graduate from high school and go to live in a community where he'd be around people who were more on his level. I mean, he grew up with a few people who dabbled in theater, but nobody was near as passionate about it as he was. And he took it as a sign he was destined to be in Broadway productions. During his sophomore year, he decided to move to New York City and aggressively pursue that career. Every night before an audition, he had his ritual. He'd walk out onto the rooftop of his apartment building, pretend he was performing his scene for the entire neighborhood, and provide those feelings of pressure and give himself one chance to get the scene right. If he jumbled his lines or didn't really achieve the right level of emotion, he'd consider it a fail and force himself to go back inside and continue to rehearse. If he did get it right on the first try, he'd give himself time to relax before the audition. Well, the building was 20-something floors, and the roof didn't have anywhere to sit, so nobody aside from him ever went up there. Most of his neighbors were elderly, and he didn't think they even cared to try to get on the roof. They probably assumed they'd sound the alarms if they did. The apartment unit was tiny, but he still missed the rooftop sometimes. The view of the surrounding area was fabulous, and it was so meditative to be up there by himself late at night. Well, one night he was preparing to go back inside when he noticed a bit of odd movement coming from another nearby rooftop. That particular building was a floor or two shorter than his own, so he had a good view of it. And just like his rooftop, it consisted of a little more in various railings and ventilation units. And the dark shape appeared to have just climbed onto the roof from the side of the building furthest away from him. In other words, something scaled the building. Couldn't believe his eyes. At first glance, he thought it was a horse. But then it stood up on 2 feet and briefly spread it looked like a pair of wings. He thought he probably was dreaming. Without making any noise, it took a few steps toward the center of the roof, and he saw what it had tucked in its left arm. Although Mike was a considerable distance away, it was no question it was like the limp body of a child. Most likely a little boy, judging from their size. They couldn't be any older than the age of 3. Well, Michael wanted to believe maybe the bizarre beast was trying to help the child, but he instantly knew otherwise when he watched it bite a chunk out of the child's upper leg. Well, in spite of himself, he yelled out and caused the beast to look up at him. He ran back inside and rushed down to the street level. He felt his only safe place was to be in public where cars passing by. So he ran straight for the payphone and was outside the nearest diner and called the police. And since the sighting sounded so strange even to him, and he's the one that saw it, he didn't want to provide his name, so he merely told him he saw a possible kidnapper on the rooftop of a building across from his own. After he gave those details, he hung up and hung out at the diner for a while, sipping on a cup of coffee. Well, when he eventually gathered enough courage to go back to his own apartment, he noticed several police cars parked outside the building where he had seen the creature, and as discreetly as possible, he walked back up to his own roof and saw the law enforcement groups investigating the scene. They're mainly focused on the heavy blood spatter in the area where he saw the creature take a bite out of the child. By that time, there was enough blood to suggest the creature resumed its meal after spotting Michael, watching him. He thought there'd be at least some mention of the incident in the newspaper the next day, but there was nothing. Checked every day for the next week or two and didn't find anything. Never went back up on his roof again because he was worried the creature might be lurking once the armed authorities vacated the premises. He didn't think there's any question what he saw that night was what many people referred to as the Jersey Devil. There's a lot of creatures that populate the night, most of whom we never see because we're not looking up. Well, we got another report. This is somebody named Cheryl. And her grandson was the one that convinced her to submit her story. Otherwise, she was quite content to say nothing. She's from one of the smallest towns in the U.S., known as Flatwoods, West Virginia. It's part of Braxton County, which is surrounded by some of the eeriest forests in the country. And even before her nightmarish event, she remembered feeling like she lived in a fairy tale land where creepy woodland creatures watched everything from the shadows. Now, looking back, she said it was a strange place for a child to grow up, but at the time, it was all she knew. In 1952, her mother's boyfriend and she faced an event creepier than anything she'd have imagined. She still thinks about it to this day. And she spent a significant portion of her life reading books about mysterious disappearances and unsolved murders. She sincerely believes the reading about the unexplainable experiences of others that helps stabilize the intense fear she frequently feels. It helps reinforce the notion that many people survived these kinds of encounters, which allowed her to see that perhaps she wasn't meant to die all those years ago. Where her mother left her father when she was 6, after a long and abusive relationship, and Cheryl remembered them getting in the most horrific fights even before she was old enough to form whole sentences. And some of those memories from the time when she was around the age of 2. Inside her playpen, she remembered watching her father throw her mother around the room. She remembered her body knocking against cabinets and tables and causing fragile objects to shadow over the floor. She was so young, she didn't know what the concept of violence was. But something about the situation prompted her brain to absorb and internalize what were later she considered beyond awful scenes. It's probably a defense mechanism her brain used. By the time she was 7, her mother had moved in with her new boyfriend. She remembered thinking how it was most awkward to see somebody treat her mother so well. She just hadn't yet witnessed anything like that in her early years. It's absurd to think how her mind could normalize something as grotesque as watching her mother received bruise after bruise all over her body from her father. She had a waitressing job back then when they still lived with her father. Cheryl later came to understand the other staff members and even patrons would ask her if she was okay. They couldn't help but notice some of her more visible injuries. Sometimes they were so bad she'd wear long sleeves during the most scorching days of summer. And her mother always played it off like she was fine, not because she was worried about what people might do to her father, but because she was concerned about what he might do had anybody confronted him. Seems he was a big guy and had a terrible temper. So the last thing her mother wanted was for her daughter to grow up knowing her father was sentenced to life in prison for manslaughter. Shortly after her mother left her father, he left town, never came back. Well, she remembered her mother later telling her that she wouldn't have been surprised to learn the man had taken his own life. Alcohol and drug abuse had driven him to the brink of insanity over the years. Well, the new boyfriend, whose name was Bill, was a guy who recently lost his wife in a car accident a few years before he and her mother started seeing each other. Maybe there existed a part of him he felt like he took his wife's presence for granted, and he vowed he'd never do that again. He treated her mother so well that it was as if the heavens sent a guardian angel to help make everything okay and make up for all the terrible moments she shared with her father. She thought that Bill knew that one of the best ways he could respect her mother was to make it sure that she had a respectable father figure in her life. On the summer nights when the mother was working late, Bill would take Cheryl out on stargazing walks. He's good at pointing out all the constellations. She even remembers him giving her a little background on Greek history. He brought her on a trail that used to walk his last dog along. Bill continued talking and pointing toward the sky when she suddenly saw what she initially thought was a person walking toward him. First, the only thing that threw both Bill and herself off was how this individual seemed to be wearing a dark dress. But as they got closer, they both realized that the creature wasn't walking. It looked like it was gliding. So Bill stepped in front of her without saying anything. His instincts warned him that whoever or whatever this figure was wasn't friendly. Untrusting what the figure might do, Bill insisted it didn't come any closer. But the creature, or the figure, continued to walk toward him as though it hadn't heard the instructions. So Bill looked at her and said, "Run home, I'll be right behind you." And Cheryl looked at him and was confused. He said, "I mean it." And then she took off running. At that time, all she could think about was getting as far as she could away from that gliding figure. And right before she began to run, she glimpsed his face. First thing that came to her mind was the red eyes. They glowed entirely on their own. And it was the light from those eyes that faintly illuminated its other features. It reminded her of a monkey's face, but it was wore some kind of hood or helmet that obstructed much of its head. Well, the last word she heard Bill say was, "Who are you? I said to stay back." He never came back to his home. When her mother got home from work, she was startled to find her sitting outside Bill's home in the dark. The house was locked, and Cheryl kept thinking it'd be any minute that the creature came back to get her. But when she explained to her mother what happened, she automatically assumed that her father had actually come back to Flatwood, just so worried he had ambushed Bill. When the police got to the house, because she called the police, the officer asked her some questions. And they decided somebody was trying to conceal their identity in an attempt to rob Bill or maybe kidnap her. Years later, her mother told her it took all the strength in the world to behave in a way that conveyed there was nothing to worry about. She felt so guilty about all the things that Cheryl witnessed between her and her father, she refused to expose her to any further trauma. But back then, Cheryl couldn't understand why they immediately moved to North Carolina. For years, she went on believing her mother's story. She met up with Bill for coffee, and they decided they were no longer good together. Made that whole thing up because she didn't want her to grow up thinking she'd witnessed the abduction of a grown man. Then when she was in her teenage years, she learned of the famous Flatwoods Monster sighting that occurred right about the time of Bill's disappearance. When she saw illustrations of the creature, she knew right then and there that Bill and she had encountered the same thing. But they didn't know what the hell it was. But she has some advice for anybody that might come in contact with something that's gliding toward you in the woods. Run. Never said what happened to Bill. Well, there are probably as many stories as there are people. Got a report from somebody named Lauren, who had the most frightening event of her life happen in the early 1990s. Every August, she said her parents would send her and her little brother Jack to summer camp for a few weeks. I was deprived. I never got to go to summer camp. Their family lived in Oregon throughout her whole childhood, so there was plenty of options to choose from. She was 12, and that year ended up being her last attending these camps because she refused to ever go again. She refused to even go to any remote wooded areas until well into her 20s. She said she hated thinking about her experience. It's hard for her to even talk about it, but she thinks we need to get these things off our chest to have any chance of encouraging a more open-minded society. It's the only way to ever be able to spread awareness that these things do happen and cryptids do roam the face of this planet. Well, during the summer that this happened, a counselor from one of their previous camps decided to start his own venture. And her parents really liked this particular guy. His name was Jacob. He's one of those people who never seemed to stop smiling. And it must have been super easy for him to instill a ton of trust among parents. Everybody liked him. But Lauren thought it was because of all that trust that people let it slide how underprepared he was to run his new business. Now, she had heard that his family was quite wealthy, so maybe they granted him the capital needed to secure the land, but neglected to check that he was abiding by the county guidelines. The location was isolated. She didn't even remember what it was called. She recently asked her parents, but they couldn't remember what it was either. And they're not even sure it had an official name. Maybe Jacob and a few of his friends drove out into the mountains until they found an unoccupied land near a river. Well, the name of the camp, she said it was rather cheesy. She called it the Happy Times Camp, just for the sake of giving it a title. The buildings on the property looked like they'd been around for a long time, but then received a fresh coat of sky blue paint. And it appeared that there had once been another camp on that property. Lauren had a bit of an off feeling when they first arrived, but she attributed it to the notion of how isolated they were. The area is beyond beautiful, she said. Aside from a roaring river, it's full of meadows and green hills and, of course, dense woodland. Weren't for the fact she was heading into her teenage years, she would have probably enjoyed the idea of being dropped off there a whole lot more. Well, she said it was probably the first or second night at Happy Times Camp that a fellow camper named Calissa screamed woke everybody in their bunkhouse in the middle of the night. She said she rolled over and saw a pair of glowing eyes staring at all of them from just outside the window. Their counselor, Julie, who slept in the at the bunkhouse with them, got up and turned on the lights, making it impossible to see anything other than what was inside. And they couldn't tell if anything was looking in from the outside. Lauren remembered Julie didn't even bother to look toward the window since she automatically concluded Calissa must have had a nightmare and woke herself up. The other girl, whose name was Sammy, complained that the next day about how she had to listen to Calissa rambling about the eyes all morning. Allegedly, she kept saying she didn't want to be at that camp anymore, but even her parents dismissed her story as what happened the previous night. With a kid, you always assume they had a nightmare. Well, aside from Calissa's unrest, the next few days played out normally enough. About 20 to 30 kids there, and they spent the afternoons playing games like dodgeball and flag football and things along those lines. Early in the trip, the counselors deemed it too unsafe to swim in a nearby section of the river. A lot of kids complained about it, but it's probably the right thing to do. They weren't even sure Jacob had acquired the appropriate permits to run the camp in the first place. So couldn't imagine how hard the legal system would have been on him if a child drowned under his supervision. They had been there about a week when Jacob announced during breakfast the counselors had located a calmer, safer section of the river, but they'd have to walk a mile to get there. Of course, the mile-long walk discouraged a bunch of the lazier kids from wanting to go, and Lauren later wondered if maybe that was part of Jacob's strategy all along. The only reason he and his friends went out searching for a calmer part of the river was that they didn't want the parents to hear there'd been no swimming throughout the whole time the kids were at camp. I mean, that would have been bad for business, don't you know? Of course, Lauren and her brother insisted on being on the first group to go swimming, and Julie was nice enough to grant them that wish. As a group of about 10 hiked along the river, none of them had a single clue about what more than likely watched us from the other side. By the time they got to a sandy, shallower bend in the river, they were all sweating profusely. And if her memory is correct, there was a natural dam that briefly broke the speed of the flow. So it made complete sense why they would have decided this was the place to take the campers for swimming. Ideally, they would have established a camp in that area, but it's probably much too wooded and encompassing terrain, too uneven and treacherous. The depth in that part of the river couldn't have been over 3 feet because Lauren recalled walking to the opposite shoreline without having to swim. Another kid named Brian was already over there stacking a mound of broken shells. Lauren remarked that she was no expert, but looked to her like they'd once belonged to a species of clam. And whatever they were, it was clear something had enjoyed an open buffet full of them. And Jack later called out from the woods, Lauren come see this, and walked her maybe 10 yards into the forest where his friend Brent found what she first thought were many piles of manure. Well, she might have guessed wrong on her estimation, but she thought there were about 15 of them. And many of them were pressed right up against large trees, making them seem like extensions of the wood rather than the separate objects. And the more time she spent observing them, the more they looked like beehives or hornet's nests, only larger. Each one is maybe a bit below her chest in height. The other interesting thing was none of these supposed nests appeared to have any openings, leading her to wonder how whatever built them got in and out. Well, soon she noticed the extensive array of holes in the soil throughout that section of forest, and there was a potent stench throughout the entire area. Lauren thought it smelled like decaying meat mixed with body odor. Hadn't been for the fact we could hear the counselors and other campers from where they stood, the three of them would have been too creeped out to continue examining the area. A few minutes later, she and Jack walked back toward the river while Brent stayed behind. He had a bunch of those small clamshells in the pockets of her bathing suit, and he started using them to design a smiley face on the side of one of the nests. He acted like this was something clever to do. And less than 10 minutes later, there was a sudden shriek caused everybody in and around the river to stop what they were doing and face the trees. And out came Brent, running and crying, holding his bloodied hand in front of him. Julie screamed what happened as she went running out of the forest to meet the little boy. He said, "It stabbed me." And Julie asked him what stabbed him before turning and asking anybody who had it to bring her a dry article of clothing. Well, you know, sometimes you get more than you bargain for when you explore. And the problem is there more things than we have any idea exist? And part of the problem is we assume in our arrogance that there's nothing we don't know. The problem is there's far more than we have any clue. And the sad thing is many of us don't even try to find out. Well, when Julie finally got Brent to calm down enough to talk to her, he said he was stabbed by an elf. Well, she didn't respond because she probably thought the kid was confused. And of course, her focus was on wrapping the wound. And even though it wasn't a fatal injury, it must have been the most blood Lauren had ever seen up to that point in her life. Up to that incident, she had probably only encountered a handful of scrapes and bloody noses. Unfortunately, that incident cut their time in the river short, and the group made its way back to camp as quickly as possible. Well, they took Brent to the camp nurse, tall, skinny guy with long, curly hair. Super friendly and probably wasn't qualified to do much in the way of treating wounds, especially deeper ones like Brent's. So for the rest of that day, nobody got much of a chance to speak to the kid because the counselors decided he needed to take it easy. And for some reason decided if they imprisoned him in the bunkhouse, he'd be okay. Now, Lauren didn't know why they did that, but the next day she found out. While they ate breakfast, her brother told her about his talk with Brent from the previous night. And something felt very off when she found out the counselors told the wounded kid not to share his story with the other campers. According to Jack, Brent claimed a little man crawled up the nest and stabbed his hand while he's designing a smiley face on clamshells. Now, that story sounded a bit ridiculous, but there was something unusual about those mounds. She started to consider the glowing eyes that Calista claimed to have seen outside the girl's bunkhouse, and she just had a feeling something unusual was lurking around the Happy Times camp. Later that afternoon, she saw Brent sitting on the bench reading a book outside the boys' bunkhouse. Since he was alone, Lauren decided it was an opportunity to see how he was doing and get some direct insight into what had happened the next day. She noticed he looked in all directions as soon as she inquired about the little man, clarifying he'd been told not to discuss it with his fellow campers. Even if the kid imagined the whole thing and accidentally stabbed himself with a sharp object, nobody should have the ability to silence him, was Lauren's feeling. Soon as he started talking about it, Lauren knew that he genuinely believed what he saw. Turned out her brother had not misunderstood Brent. Everything he mentioned to her after his talk with Brent elaborated on. Now, we've come to the end of today's show, and we're going to talk about the little man and a lot of other things after we come back for our next show. Until then, this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show, saying have a truly great evening.